You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, here's Pastor Sandy as he teaches through the book of Ecclesiastes, chapters 1 through 4.
Well, here's a Peanuts comic strip. Charlie Brown and Lucy are engaged in a philosophical conversation. It's a heavy conversation. Lucy is explaining the mysteries of life. She says, "Life is like a deck chair, Charlie Brown. Some place it so they can see where they're going. Some place it so that they can see where they've been. And some place it so they can see where they are at present." Charlie Brown responds, "I can't even get mine unfolded." Well, in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is having difficulty unfolding his deck chair. He is disappointed with life. He is disillusioned by life. I've heard it put like this: we start out life expecting to discover a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but all we find is a bowl of salty liver soup. You see, Solomon has tasted life, but he can't get used to the bitter aftertaste. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, we embark with Solomon on a search for fulfillment. What is meaningful in life? And over, he asks the question, what's the point of it all anyway? Well, brace yourself for Solomon's answers, or the lack thereof. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1 begins, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." Now, this Hebrew term translated preacher is a unique word. It's found nowhere else in Scripture. It takes the word kahal, which means to gather or assemble, and turns it into a brand new word, kehileth, which means the leader of a group or one who addresses the assembly. You know, it's interesting, when the Hebrew gets translated into Greek, the word for assembly is ekklesia, which in our English New Testament ends up being translated church. So Ecclesiastes is the leader of the ekklesia. In essence, he's the preacher. And notice the preacher is identified. He's the son of David and the king of Jerusalem. This narrows our options down to one man. His name was Solomon. And David's kid Solomon was king of Jerusalem at its zenith. In the middle of the 10th century BC, Israel was the world's lone superpower. Solomon was the wealthiest and smartest and most powerful man on the planet. People would come from all over the world to marvel at Solomon's wealth and at his wisdom. Solomon wrote 3 books of the Bible. The Song of Solomon was written when he was young and in love. Proverbs was written in his middle years at the height of his greatness, whereas Ecclesiastes was probably written later in his life, after Solomon had strayed from God. Remember, Solomon married pagan wives and embraced their idols. He turned his back on God, and he tried to find meaning in life apart from God. And Ecclesiastes is Solomon's report. The king travels down the path of science and philosophy. He turns to pleasure, then to achievement. He moves on to religion and materialism and fame and power. He contemplates the value of hard work and long life and a large family and a good name. He turns over every rock possible, looking for some meaning in life. One Hebrew scholar writes, "No era of Israel's history was richer in possibilities for various pleasures, and no person in a better position to make the most of them than Solomon." The king tried everything folks are prone to try in an attempt to make themselves happy if they only had the money. Well, Solomon, he could drop the cash. But in the end, he found nothing that truly satisfied him. And he states his conclusion at the outset, verse 2. "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, man. All is vanity. Here is a key word in Ecclesiastes. It occurs 37 times. In Hebrew, it's the word hevel. The English translation is vanity. It means vapor or mist. It implies emptiness, hollowness, the lack of fulfillment. It's another way of saying, why bother? Who cares? Why roll out of the sack and get out of bed? Nothing really matters. Here's a great way of saying it. Whatever. That's vanity. Life is vanity. Life is nothing more than a puff of breath on a cold day. It's like the steam you wipe off your glasses on a humid afternoon. I like this definition of vanity. It's whatever is left after you break a soap bubble. You see, life without God is like chasing after soap bubbles. Little kids at a birthday party, they chase and they chase the bubbles, but the instant they capture their prize, it pops between their fingers and they're left with nothing to show for their efforts. Sadly, adults play the same game. Life is an inescapable maze. Every path Solomon takes turns out to be a dead end. And Solomon questions the futility of life in verse 3. He says, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? And here's another key phrase in Ecclesiastes. It occurs 29 times. It's the phrase, under the sun. You see, in his quest for meaning, Solomon limits his search to things under the sun. Not heavenly things, mind you, but earthly things. His boundaries are here below. The material, the physical, the terrestrial. The king kept God out of the equation. Solomon tries to make sense of life without God. And Solomon is not the only man who has conducted this experiment. There are other brilliant, wealthy men who've tried and yet have come to the same conclusions. George Bernard Shaw, he once moaned, "Life is a series of inspired follies." There's a French proverb that reiterates life's frustration. It goes, life is an onion. When it's peeled, there's nothing left, and one cries the whole time peeling it. Here's an optimistic view of life. The Jewish rabbi Sholem Aleichman wrote, life is a blister on top of a tumor and a boil on top of that. Philosopher Joseph Crutch, he writes, a man's life has no more meaning than the life of the humblest insect crawling from one annihilation to another. William Cowper described life apart from God as the toil of dropping buckets into empty wells and growing old in drawing up nothing. Henry Thoreau wrote, the mass of men live lives of quiet desperation. And of course, that great philosopher, Charlie Brown, once concluded, I have a new philosophy. I am only going to dread one day at a time. If all there is to life is what's under the sun, then I too would be pessimistic. But Jesus tells us that that's not all there is to life. On several occasions, Jesus spoke of coming down from above. There is life above the sun. Jesus spoke of eternal life, of spiritual life, of life above the sun. And this is what makes life worth living. Jesus tells us in John 10, verse 10, I have come that you may have life and that you may have it more abundantly. Because of Jesus, life is not all vanity. Life is not worthless. Life can be satisfying and fulfilling, but it only takes that shape when we look above the sun, when we get above the things that are material and physical, when we look to Jesus and the life he can offer us. Look under the sun and life's a drag. Look to the sun, S-O-N, above the sun, S-U-N, and earthly life takes on a whole new meaning. You see, the world we occupy is a fallen world. It's been scarred and marred by sin. Here's what's happened. We've cut ties with the Creator, and the result has been endless frustration. But Jesus reconnects us to God on the cross. He reconnected the tether between us and God. And as we grow in our relationship with God and relate our lives to God, here's what happens. The value of everything else in life gets marked up. Everyday existence takes on eternal significance. H.G. Wells words it this way. He says, until a man has found God and been found by God, he begins at no beginning. He works to no end. He may have friendships, his partial loyalties, his scraps of honor. But all these things fall into place, and life falls into place only with God. And this is the truth Solomon discovers, and he teaches us here in Ecclesiastes. He continues in verse 4, one generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Solomon compares here the temporal nature of man with the permanence of nature. And it's frustrating. Think about it. The trees in your front yard are going to outlive you. How encouraging is that? I mean, our lives are mere blips on the radar screen of history. You see, Solomon views life as a treadmill. Every generation takes its turn trying to get somewhere, but then it gives up and gives way to the next. Verse 5 tells us the sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around toward the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. In other words, nature runs like clockwork. The sun rises and then the sun sets. The wind comes and then the wind blows and goes. Life goes on, and you and I have little bearing on the grand scheme of things. Life goes on with us or without us. He notices all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. Solomon becomes a meteorologist. He observes the evaporation cycle. Rain fills the rivers. Rivers in turn fill the oceans. Oceans evaporate and water returns to earth as rain. And this is just one example. All of life is cyclical. Here's Solomon's point. There's motion, but there's no meaning. There's motion in life, but there's no meaning to life. Mankind is trapped in this monotonous rut called life. Generations come and go. The actors are always changing, but the stage and the script and the storyline remain the same. You know, you sense this when you go to Europe. If you've ever had the opportunity to go to Europe, you really sense this. You know, American houses are at most 100 years old. You find some of those up north, down south here. They were all burned to the ground by Sherman. But occasionally you'll find an older house. And you go to that house, you can appreciate it. Maybe one, two, maybe three generations have lived in that house. But when you go to Europe, the buildings there, some of them are 1,000 years old. And you realize that generation after generation after generation have lived in these homes. The individual person is constantly reminded that he's just one of a succession, a whole train of people that have been here and lived and died and passed on. You come to the conclusion that we're just all drips in the sea of humanity. And this is why people long for something new and for something novel. For when we come up with something we think is new, it makes us feel special. It distinguishes us from other generations. He says in verse 8, all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. You see, our world loves to latch on to the latest fad or the latest fashion because it's our way of trying to beat back life's monotony. We say, oh, this is new. Wow, this has never been. That makes us somehow special. Solomon confesses, though, in verse 10, is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. You know, when you get excited about a new song you hear or a new invention or a new gadget or a new style or a new thought or a new cause, just remember that there have been new innovations before. And usually it's the same stuff recycled over and over. You know, I'm reminded of this whenever one of my kids sports a fad or a fashion that was popular when I was young. Oh, Dad, skateboarding is so cool. We used to skateboard down that hill when I was 10 years old, you know. Just hang on to your old clothes long enough and they'll eventually be back in style. Old fashioned becomes vintage. The Greek philosopher Marcus Aurelius wrote, they that come after us will see nothing new. They who went before us saw nothing more than we have seen. Here's another way of putting it. The ancients have stolen all our best ideas. Verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. I mean, the reason we get so excited over something that's novel, it's because of our ignorance of history. We don't check the minutes of the last meeting. History's so repetitive. And this makes the promise of Jesus in Revelation 21, verse 5, so amazing and so appealing. For there he says, behold, I make all things new. The monotony of this life won't be broken. We won't escape fully the rut of life completely until Jesus returns to earth. But when he comes, he promises to make all things new. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. Solomon made it his quest to search out meaning. He viewed it as his duty. And here he states his conclusion. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Solomon was the wisest man on earth, yet in searching for fulfillment, apart from God, he proved a fool. Under the sun, life is just soap bubbles. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. Listen to this verse in the Living Bible. What is wrong cannot be righted. It is water over the dam, and there is no use thinking of what might have been. He's saying every life is full of regrets. We're all victims of unrealized possibilities, of missed opportunities. It's frustrating. Solomon reflects on his own frustrations. He says, I communed with my heart saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. In other words, the more we learn, the more conscious we become of our ignorance. You know, the old proverb is true, a wise man is never happy. It reminds me of the father who bought his son the perfect Christmas present. He thought that this would teach the child a life lesson. It would prepare him for life. It was a puzzle whose pieces didn't fit. That no matter how you twisted the pieces, no matter how you assembled them, they didn't connect. You see, this is the problem with life. When you try to sort life out without God, nothing connects. Nothing makes sense. The pieces don't fit. As one person said, life goes on, I just forgot why. In chapter 2, Solomon searches for purpose in pleasure. He says, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this also was vanity. Solomon became the Hebrew hedonist. For a time, he lived for pleasure alone. If it felt good, he did it. He grabbed for all the gusto. He enjoyed the high life. You've heard the Reebok tag, life is short, play hard. Well, Solomon played hard. The Bible tells us the old guy had 700 wives and 300 concubines. That means a different woman every night. Solomon's palace was like the Playboy mansion. It was a perpetual party. And then he adds, I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? Solomon tried entertainment. He indulged in comedy, he says. Laughter and mirth. He hired Leno and Letterman to do stand-up for him every night. He called me, but I was booked. I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. Solomon became a connoisseur of fine wines. And we're not talking the cheap stuff, man. This guy was rich. He knocked down $50,000 bottles like they were soft drinks. With Solomon's unlimited salary. His parties made the strip in Las Vegas look like a two-bit carnival. He partied hardy, but he found no peace in his pleasure. He found no satisfaction in his sensuality. He found no contentment in his cravings. And if ever there was a people that were trying to duplicate Solomon's pursuits, it would be 21st century America. For we too are a pleasure-crazed society. Food. Hey, we've got a network now, the food network. And wine, and sex, and entertainment, and resorts, and spas, and casinos, and holidays, and sports, and massages. And we spare no expense to try to fill the hollowness inside. And yet Solomon is saying, when the party's over, there's still an aching emptiness. You see, here's an analysis. Here's a nutshell analysis of today's values. We live in a day when anything goes, but nothing lasts. Doesn't that sum it up? Anything goes, but nothing lasts. Boy, the same could be said for Solomon. You know, when the woman at the well came seeking water, Jesus told her, "You'll thirst again." And we would do well to turn that phrase into a plaque and hang it over every source of modern day pleasure. Sex, you'll thirst again. Sports, you'll thirst again. Money, you'll thirst again. Fame, you'll thirst again. Drugs, you'll thirst again. You may get it, but it won't be enough. You'll thirst again. Jesus alone is the soul's thirst quencher. Nothing else can satisfy. Pleasure's fun for a time, but when the party is over, life is still vanity. You wake up with a hangover and in an empty house. And speaking of houses, here's another place where Solomon looked for satisfaction. In verse 4, he describes his crib for MTV. He says, "I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove." I mean, he took up architecture and construction. He started working in the yard to try to find meaning. And yet it too was vanity. You know, 1 Kings chapter 7 tells us that Solomon spent 7 years building God's house, the temple. But he spent 13 years building his own house. His palace was unlike any other building in Jerusalem. Its gardens, its fountains, its porticos were spectacular. Solomon's palace was the ultimate dream house. And in verse 7, Solomon talks about his posse. You know, I'm sure the king thought that if he had enough people around him, waiting on him hand and foot, then surely he'd be happy. Verse 7, "I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Some 30,000 servants catered to Solomon's every whim. He had publicists and personal chefs and masseuses and drivers and secretaries and trainers and money managers and event planners." You know, you can be around people, you can be surrounded by people and yet remain absolutely lonely if you lack a relationship with God. He says, "Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. Man, I had cattle." That means he ate prime rib every night. Verse 8, "I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces." King Solomon was probably not just the richest man on earth at his time, but the richest man that has ever been. The richest man in history.
There's more to discover in the book of Ecclesiastes, but this is where we need to pause for today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio. This program is a ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams and Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain, located in Atlanta, Georgia. We'd love to have you come be a part of our Sunday morning worship service if you're in the area. We gather at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. to spend time in communication with God through prayer and praise and studying through His Word verse by verse, chapter by chapter. We'd love to have you join us, so visit sandyadams.org to get directions. While you're at our website, you'll be able to listen to other teachings from Pastor Sandy's audio archive or read insightful articles and blog posts. Download our mobile app to stay connected to Sandy Adams Radio and take the messages you've heard here on the go. You can even find links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. All of this is found at sandyadams.org. Before we leave you for the day, we'd like to ask you to consider partnering with us as we continue to share the hope of Jesus through this ministry. Would you pray about financially contributing to Sandy Adams Radio? All donations are useful and so appreciated. Find out more by clicking on donate at sandyadams.org. Thank you for bringing this before the Lord, and thank you for tuning in today for Sandy Adams Radio.